This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, in for Bob Kinzel. For those who think winter is too long, there is one thing that signals that the end is getting closer. It's when baseball players report to Florida and Arizona and spring training begins. For the last two decades, it's also the time when I start reading a new baseball book. This year, I picked up The Betrayal by Charles Fountain. It's a new look at the 1919 Chicago Black Sox scandal, which is one of my favorite baseball topics. But then on Monday, another new book came my way, and I shifted gears. Set in the same time frame, The Selling of the Babe, The Deal That Changed Baseball and Created a Legend, is written by Glenn Stout, a noted baseball author and writer from Alberg. And Glenn joins us today on Vermont Edition to talk about the sale of Babe Ruth from the Red Sox to the Yankees. Glenn, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much.
All right, let's start, for those who haven't heard the myth, what has been the narrative, the general story about why the Red Sox sold Babe Ruth to the Yankees?
Well, the myth, the so-called curse of the Bambino,
right,
was that the Red Sox owner, Harry Frazee, was desperate for money, and he wanted to produce a Broadway show. He was a theater producer, and he sold Babe Ruth to finance the musical No, No, Nanette, which eventually netted him millions of dollars. It's patently false, that story. And provably so, but nevertheless, it got a lot of traction, and a lot of people still believe it to be true.
If I'm not mistaken, I took the Fenway tour a few years ago, and they were telling that story on the tour. These are Red Sox organizational people telling that story.
Yeah, it's an easy story to tell because it's quick and it's quick and it's easy. The truth is somewhat more complicated, I think much more fascinating, and the truth always tells a better story. But the curse of the Bambino is nice and tidy and gave a nice clean excuse for why the Red Sox didn't win for so long. That way you didn't have to face other issues like incompetent management, mm-hmm, racism, things of that nature.
Well, we'll get to the real story eventually, but let's set it up. We'll start looking at the Babe himself. A lot of people know about his on-field exploits with the Yankees, but give us some background on his playing career from 1914 to 1919 with the Sox.
Well, you know, Babe was a pitcher. He came in as a pitcher, and from almost the first time he stepped on the mound at Fenway, becoming a full-time major leaguer in 1915, he was one of the best left-handed pitchers in baseball. He had a great fastball. He had great control. He was best known, I think, for when he went up against the great Walter Johnson, and he bettered Walter Johnson, who everyone thought was the best pitcher in baseball, more often than not. And Ruth was one of the leaders of the Red Sox pitching staff in 1915, 16, 17, and into 1918. And, of course, the Red Sox were in the World Series in 15, 16, and 18. So he was a frontline pitcher for a championship team. And, you know, there was no Hall of Fame then, but seemed on his way to a Hall of Fame pitching career.
And what's kind of interesting is you mentioned these guys in the book. There were a couple of Vermonters that actually played alongside Babe Ruth with the Sox at the time.
Sure. Well, one was Ray Collins, who was, I believe, from Colchester.
Yep.
You know, and then there was
a marker, a historic marker at his farm.
Historic marker. Then there was Larry Gardner from Enosburg. So, you know, Vermont has a long tradition of Red Sox players coming from up here and playing for the Red Sox.
Listeners, what version of the story, the sale of the Babe, have you heard? And do you think this is the reason the Yankees went on to dominate while the Sox had to wait until 2004 to win another World Series? I want to hear from you today. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. All right. Babe Ruth was this big man with a big personality. Tell us what the guy was really like.
Well, you know, when he was with the Red Sox, he was a babe in the woods, so to speak. You know, he'd grown up mostly in an orphanage. He wasn't very worldly. He got to Boston, and all of a sudden he had money. All of a sudden he had attention. And he approached the world like it was a sandwich, and he'd been hungry his entire life. And he indulged in absolutely everything he could. And sometimes to the detriment of his playing career, and sometimes to the detriment of the next day's game, because the Babe would be found passed out on the street, drunk, still in the morning. But, you know, despite the fact that he was in very many ways a selfish player and very, very self-centered, he was also completely guileless. No one really blamed it for it. They would just roll their eyes. That's who he is. we'll put up with it. He couldn't remember his teammates' names. He called them all kid. But there was never any malice in Ruth, even though he was absolutely self-absorbed and absolutely just followed his own appetites wherever they led him.
Well, how did it affect the clubhouse and the other players on the Sox?
Well, at certain times it did get in the way because particularly as Babe kind of became a bigger player, a bigger figure in the game, he would sometimes just not show up or jump the team. Take off without permission because he felt that he could do whatever he wanted. And if he felt like driving all night and going back to Baltimore, well, that's what he would do. And at times it did cause some dissension on the team and some jealousy among other players. And of course, he was always getting in run-ins with his manager, Ed Barrow, and being disciplined and fined. And none of that ever seemed to have much of an impact on Ruth. He would behave for a short time and then go right back to the same behavior he had before.
But he also got along. He was an everyman. He got along with people on the train. He would, you tell in the book about him getting early and helping the concessionaires.
Oh, yeah. He'd go into ballpark in the morning, and he identified with kids very well, and he'd help them bag peanuts. And then he'd give them a nickel tip when they were done. And, you know, when the kids are shagging flies in the outfield, Ruth would be with them. He did not see himself as separate from fans at all. He was just one of them. And, you know, he had this big cartoonish face. He was someone you could identify with. And even his backstory, the street urchin who picked himself up from nothing, you know, that's an American story. That's the immigrant story. And people really identified with that and saw themselves in him. They saw in his success, they saw some of their own success.
Yeah, came from Baltimore, was at the orphanage.
Right.
You mentioned his pitching prowess with the Sox. So let's talk about that transition, because most people know him as the outfielder, the home run hitter. How did he become that guy?
World War I. That's the simplest explanation, because the United States entered World War I. A lot of ball players in 1918 had to enter military service. And in spring training during 1918, Ruth started fooling around playing a lot of outfield. The Red Sox didn't have a lot of players right then, so they let him play some outfield. He got some at-bats, he hit some home runs, and got some attention that way. And then as the season went on and the Red Sox remained short of players, he would occasionally get some time in the outfield. He did pretty well as a hitter. He wasn't like an enormous success right away, but he did hit home runs, which nobody else was doing. He didn't hit them all the time, but when he did hit them, he hit them really far, and people paid attention.
In the dead ball era.
In the dead ball era. I mean, that's when, you know, you could lead the league with 6 or 8 home runs. And, you know, Ruth got a lot of attention for that, and it helped out the ball club. And so for much of the 1918 season, he would play the outfield 2 or 3 days and then pitch a game and then play the outfield for another few games. So he was a two-way player, and baseball has had very, very few of those.
And explain what the dead ball was compared to the live ball.
Yeah, the dead ball was the ball that they used previous to 1919, and it was, you know, wrapped with wool made out of horsehide. What happened during World War I is the higher quality wool and higher quality horsehide was taken by the government to support the war effort. So the ball got even deader, and the players complained. Everybody complained. No one was scoring runs. No one was getting hits. So what they did to counteract that was they wound the wool tighter. Well, that made the ball somewhat more lively, but then after the war, they never changed the machines back once they got higher quality wool, higher quality horsehide. So after the war, beginning in 1919 and certainly by 1920, better quality baseballs were more lively, easier to hit for home runs. And guess who was there trying for home runs? Babe Ruth.
Well, talk about his swing, because his swing was different from what other players were doing at that time.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, at that time, most ball players took a level swing. They almost pushed at the ball more than swinging at it. But Ruth was a pitcher. Nobody cared how he hit. So Ruth swung from his heels. He swung with a big uppercut. It didn't matter, so nobody told him to change. And then he actually started making contact and hitting those home runs. And over time, he developed this new method of swinging where he's holding the bat right at the bottom by the knob. He's swinging with an uppercut. He's using a really heavy bat. He's swinging as hard as he can every single time. Nobody had done that before.
Now, were a lot of other players, especially as the World War I hit, were a lot of other players doing double duty, pitchers playing in the outfield or in the field?
A little bit, but not to the degree Ruth was. You know, some players had to shift positions, and there were a few players who pitched and played in the field, but no one to the degree that Ruth did. He took it to another level.
Yeah, because in the book, you kind of poo-poo his dual role. I mean, you say, you know, in lower, in the minor leagues or in college ball, high school ball, you know, people play both. But, you know, here you are, you have two different skills of throwing, and he had a pretty good arm from the outfield, mm-hmm. where you want to throw a laser like a Dave Parker to home plate. On the mound, you want to endure and throw,
right.
you know, high 90s or in the 80s with a fastball like Roger Clemens. So, you know, wasn't this really incredible, kind of like Chuck Bednarik playing 60 minutes with the Eagles?
Yeah, it really was. And kind of the interesting thing to me is why they haven't really tried it since with anybody. Because if you had somebody who could hit like Ruth and could also pitch, that's an incredibly valuable thing to be able to do. But and it is done at basically every other level but professional baseball. But in the major leagues, it's considered too difficult. Arms are too precious. I think they worry about a pitcher hurting his arm by playing in the field, vice versa. So they don't do it. But, you know, there is that brief time period in 1918 and for part of 1919 where Ruth did double duty. And even by advanced baseball metrics, he was so incredibly valuable doing two things at once. It's rather surprising that nobody's tried it since.
Tim Wakefield is a guy who could have. Possibly. He came up as an outfielder.
Right. He came up as a hitter. And there have also been guys who've switched back and forth a little bit, but nothing to the degree that Ruth did.
All right. So the 1918 season was really one of baseball's worst. Kind of explain what was going on in Major League Baseball at the time.
Well, because of the war was affecting everything. And the government wasn't quite sure if baseball was necessary during the war effort. So Ban Johnson, the president of the American League, the founder of the American League, the czar of the American League, because he ran it like his own fiefdom, Ban Johnson kind of went along with Major League Baseball and was ready to shut the season down. And some of the owners, led by Boston owner Harry Frazee, thought that that was a bad idea. I mean, he'd just bought the club a few years before. He wanted to make some money. And they kind of went around Ban Johnson and petitioned the government, and the government allowed the baseball season to continue, truncated by about a month, but they allowed it to finish and allowed the World Series to be played. The end result of that started this big battle between Harry Frazee and a couple of other owners. He was aligned with Charles Comiskey of the White Sox and the Yankees, Jake Rupert, against Ban Johnson and the other owners. And that caused an enormous split in the league. From that time on, Ban Johnson wanted to get Harry Frazee out of Boston. He wanted to take the franchise, the Red Sox franchise, away from him and be done with him. Harry Frazee, at the same time, dug in his heels and was like, I'm not giving up this team. So the two men were at loggerheads.
Okay, so Harry Frazee is a guy who has worn goat horns, you know, with the
right.
Red Sox Nation for years. Give us some background on him. You know, who was he? How did he become the Red Sox owner?
Well, the important thing to remember about Harry Frazee is in the traditional Curse of the Bambino story, he's considered this minor theatrical producer and figure. Whereas in reality, Harry Frazee was one of the most successful theatrical producers of his time. He was from Peoria, Illinois. He first reached success in Chicago. His genius as a theater producer was when he had a hit show, he'd put another version of it on the road right away. So if he had a hit in Chicago, well, they were seeing the same show in Peoria and they were seeing the same show in Springfield, and he was able to make a lot of money that way. He eventually moved to New York, had the same success on Broadway that he had elsewhere, made a lot of money, was always interested in baseball, and made a few forays into, you know, attempting to buy teams before the Red Sox. But then he finally bought the Red Sox from Joseph Lannan in 1916, or after the 1916 season. And, you know, Lannan was having his own little battle with Ban Johnson at the time and sold it to Frazee without permission, which was kind of the first offense that made Ban Johnson angry. But make no mistake, Harry Frazee was an incredibly successful theatrical producer before he ever owned the Boston Red Sox.
But was he a competent owner of the Boston Red Sox?
Well, you have to give him credit for one thing. When he first took over the team, he made a series of trades that delivered a pennant in 1918. And, you know, for years, people would say the Red Sox haven't won since 1918. They blame Harry Frazee. But Harry Frazee was the reason they won in 1918 because he acted aggressively in a year where a lot of other owners were afraid of the war, and Harry wasn't. He was aggressive, acquired all these players, and the Red Sox won a pennant in a World Series as a result.
Now, the 1919 series was really a pivotal one in this whole dance. So what was going on in the Red Sox team that year?
Well, in 1919, Ruth started to be a bit of a problem. He really became enamored with hitting in 1918. And when he showed up in 1919, he was like, hey, guys, I don't want to play. I don't want to pitch anymore. I just want to hit and play outfield. And they indulged him a little bit early on. They seemed to have enough pitching with people coming back from the war. But that didn't last very long. And Ruth, for the first month of the 1919 season, was terrible as a hitter. He basically did nothing. So after the first month of the season, with Ruth playing the outfield and not pitching, the Red Sox weren't winning. They were out of the pennant race 5 weeks into the season. At that point, Ruth re-enters the rotation, starts to pitch a little bit, but it's too late then. The season's already gone. He also starts to hit a little bit. In fact, he starts to hit a lot. He hits in streaks over the course of the 1919 season and hits more home runs over the course of the season than any player in the game to date. He ends up with 29 home runs that year. That was extraordinary. That's as crazy as, you know, Steph Curry of the Golden State Warriors, you know, hitting every shot from half court. That's how revolutionary it was.
Now, part of the reason that he might have picked up steam and started hitting home runs in the second half is because some of the old balls from World War I,
that's right,
still dead balls, the Major League team still had in their stock. They kind of run out somewhere during that season, and now the new balls that are juicier, livelier, come into play.
That's right. The old balls, they use them all up. They've got these new balls that are more tightly wound, better quality, and the ball starts to sail. Because not only does Ruth start hitting home runs, but league-wide hitting goes up. League-wide home runs go up. So Ruth is kind of ahead of the wave, but he's riding a wave that's lifting everybody at the same time. But due to the fact that he's swinging from his heels and nobody else is, he gets the most out of it.
We're talking about Babe Ruth, Harry Frazee, and baseball in 1919. Coming up, we'll find out why the Sox really did sell the Babe to the Yanks. No, it's probably not what you've heard in the past. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Where do you come down on Harry Frazee? Did he destroy the Red Sox, or did he actually save the franchise and Fenway Park? You can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Rick Singeri. This is Vermont Edition. As the Red Sox slogged through 86 years without a World Series title, there was a lot of blame to go around, but most of it landed squarely on Harry Frazee. He's the guy who owned the team when Babe Ruth was sold to the Yankees. Author Glenn Stout has written a new book on the subject, The Selling of the Babe, and we're discussing the circumstances of the deal. You can promote your theory or ask Glenn a question about the sale. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post them on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. All right, Glenn, let's get down to the actual sale of the Babe. Did it have anything to do with No-No Nanette?
No. Nothing whatsoever. In fact, if you think it did, you would have to, you know, think that somehow he took that money, put it in a box, lived for like 4 years, produced a handful of other plays that were also very successful, then took it out and bought Babe Ruth. That didn't happen.
Because the sale was the end of 1919.
And No-No Nanette was 1924, 1925.
Gotcha.
A long time away. Although the play it was based on was a play that he had in production in 1919. In between 1919 and 1924, 1925, he bought theaters, he produced other plays. So there's just no connection there whatsoever.
Okay. And we also think of the Red Sox and the Yankees as bitter rivals. A few years ago at an event at VTC, at Vermont Technical College, to raise money for those who lost a lot during Irene, the GMs of the two teams talked about how they would never make trades with one another now. But that relationship in 1919 between Frazee and Yankees owner Jacob Rupert wasn't that way at all, was it?
No, not at all. They were both aligned with each other against Ben Johnson, and they both worked with each other to battle Ben Johnson and to protect each other from the reach of Ben Johnson, because Ben Johnson didn't really care for either of them, and Ben Johnson would have been happy if both of them would have been out of baseball. So much of the dynamic that went into the sale of Ruth had to do with that, had to do with each of those people, Harry Frazee and Jacob Rupert, preserving their team, keeping control of their team, keeping out of the reaches of Ben Johnson.
So what are the reasons you think Babe Ruth was sold to the Yankees?
Well, one of the big reasons had to do with Fenway Park. Harry Frazee did not own Fenway Park, and Ben Johnson was making moves to take over Fenway Park. And if he had gotten possession of Fenway Park, then he could have forced a sale. If Johnson owned Fenway Park and Frazee didn't, where's his team going to play? He's going to have to give up his team. He wanted to get full value for his team. That wouldn't have been able to happen. At the meantime, the Yankees were doing battle with the New York Giants in New York. And Jacob Rupert needed a draw because, guess what? Prohibition was coming in. He was a brewer. The Rupert Brewery was the most successful in New York. That had been his major business. But with Prohibition coming up, now baseball had to be his major business. And thus far for him, the Yankees had been a loser. They'd been the weak sister to the New York Giants. So heads get together, plots start to thicken, and Rupert needs a big draw. Frazee needs to strengthen his alliance to fend off Ben Johnson. So by selling Ruth, it didn't finance No-No Nanette, but it did eventually allow Frazee to take possession of Fenway Park, which enabled him to keep the Red Sox.
And Ruth's act was getting kind of old in Boston.
At the end of the 1919 season, he breaks every home run record there is, and then the Red Sox go on the road for the end of the season. And at the very last day of the season, Babe Ruth, instead of showing up to play for the Red Sox, he jumps the team and plays an exhibition game to line his own pocket elsewhere. That's not the first time he had done that. He had done that repeatedly over the last several seasons, just jumping the team and taking money to play for someone else, violating his contract, holding out on his contract, politicking for more money. And I think it was one of those situations where Frazee saw that Ruth was becoming a headache, saw that he was also becoming very costly and that he could never afford to pay him. And it was one of those situations where he thought, maybe I can sell him at a, you know, sell high right now because Ruth might not be able to keep this up. He's behaviorally out of control. He's starting to get injured. I'll sell him now. I'll get the most I can.
But he didn't get the most he could, I don't think, because in 1918, he could have probably got about $150,000 to $200,000. He settled for $100,000 in 1919.
Right. He got a little bit less there, but he got it at very favorable terms from the Yankees. And there was that clause in the contract that said for other considerations. Those other considerations, 5 months later, ended up being the mortgage at Fenway Park, which, by having the Yankees take over the mortgage, effectively kept it out of the hands of, guess who, Ben Johnson, because the Yankees and the Red Sox were in alliance with one another. So it was one of those deals that kind of made everybody happy at the time, but Ben Johnson, who was foiled in his effort to get rid of both men, but it allowed each of them to survive and go forward.
Listeners, you can join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Going to take a break from the sale question for a moment and talk to Dana in Dorset, who has a question about Babe Ruth. Dana, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What is your question?
Hi. A number of years ago, I lived in Baltimore for a few years, and from time to time I would run into people who expressed the opinion that Babe Ruth was passing, that he was really black but was able to pass for white. And I was wondering if there was any truth to that.
Mm-hmm. The people that have been Ruth's foremost biographers have debunked that. There's no evidence that Ruth was African-American. But I will tell you one funny story. One of my early mentors was a man named Doc Counts, who was a African-American sports writer in Boston. And Doc Counts told me that his family always thought that Babe Ruth was African American. And in fact, if you look in the black press in the 1920s and 1930s, Ruth is often included with the biggest stars of the Negro Leagues as being African American. He was not, but he was claimed. And Ruth apparently had no issues, no racial issues whatsoever. He was great friends with Bill Bojangles Robinson. So no, that's not true. But it's also kind of indicative of the power of Ruth that everyone wanted to claim that Ruth was one of theirs.
He was loved. I mean, this guy, every time he'd hit a home run, it didn't matter if the Sox won or lost. That was the story,
sure,
him hitting a home run.
Sure. And let's not forget that here was Ruth, a German-American, who just a couple of years after World War I was the most popular person in the country. And at the same time, the name, the Bambino, well, that was given to him by the Italian-American fans in the bleachers in New York, who called him the Babe, the Bambino.
Oh, great point. All right. So we talked about why he was sold. What do you think, in hindsight, knowing how Ruth went on to have this amazing career in New York, was this the right deal? Was this a good deal for the Red Sox?
Well, if you could look into a crystal ball, it clearly was not. But the problem is then you couldn't look into a crystal ball. You had no way of knowing that Babe Ruth was going to go on and hit another 650 or so home runs. The other factor there, and I looked at this very, very closely, is given how great Ruth became, there was, I think, simply no way that Boston could have ever gotten the number of fans in the ballpark to support him in a town that was already struggling to support two major league teams. Boston wasn't nearly as big as New York. Boston didn't have the fan base. To pay Ruth what Ruth eventually demanded was far more than the salaries either the Boston Braves or the Red Sox paid for the entire rest of their team. He would have bankrupted them. He would have eventually had to have been sold or traded anyway because they just couldn't have afforded to pay him.
All right, I'm going to take issue with the fact that you couldn't tell, because I'm reading, you know, about the seasons that he played with the Red Sox that you write about,
mm-hmm.
and I can tell he's a budding superstar.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't the baseball people in Boston, Ed Barrow in particular, know that this guy had the potential to be something, you know, very, very big?
Well, I think part of it was because he was so anomalous as a player, they didn't believe what he was doing. I mean, John McGraw, the manager of the New York Giants, said, oh my gosh, he's going to hit into more double plays than anybody in baseball. And at that time, too, you know, Ruth was striking out. That was a sin in baseball. You know, it was better to make an out than to strike out. Striking out was like the worst thing you could do, even though we know now that that's not the worst thing you can do. Back then, that was considered, oh, you just can't do that. So Ruth ran counter to so many assumptions that longtime baseball people at that time had, that I don't think they just believed it. They also worried about him because of his behavior, because of his drinking, because of the way was already starting to put on weight and had hurt his knee and had been sick. People were wondering if he was going to last. You know, I don't think you could have predicted in 1919 that Babe Ruth was going to play another 14 years. It didn't seem very likely then that he was going to live another 4 years, much less play baseball for 14 years.
It's interesting when we talk about his behaviors, you do mention that no one really ever writes about this, but he probably was an alcoholic.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, to think that Ruth was not an alcoholic would be to think that he couldn't play baseball. He drank all the time, every day, basically from the time he got up to the time he went to bed.
Okay. So here comes the live ball era. The baseballs are going to change. The Red Sox, Major League Baseball, knew that there was something changing mm-hmm. with the ball. As a matter of fact, in the 1919 exhibition season, Babe Ruth is using a more juiced ball, a livelier ball, in games in Tampa and elsewhere, and he is hitting it a ton. So I own the Red Sox. I see we have this big talent. Don't I know? Can I put two and two together and say, with a juiced ball, with a livelier ball, and this guy's swing, this is going to be incredible.
Mm-hmm. One problem with that.
Go ahead.
And the problem with that is Fenway Park. Ruth, even in 1919, did not hit in Fenway Park like he hit everywhere else. Fenway Park, a deep right field, short left field. Babe Ruth, pull hitter. A lot of Ruth's longest drives in Boston fell short of the fence and were outs. Now, the difference was, and which was made him so attractive to the Yankees, who at that time played in the Polo Grounds in New York, is that in the Polo Grounds, right field was extremely short, well under 300 feet. As a pull hitter, Ruth put the ball into the seats in the Polo Grounds like he did nowhere else. In the Polo Grounds, he was already Babe Ruth. In Fenway Park, he was not Babe Ruth, the Babe Ruth that we know today as a hitter. He was getting better at it, but he wasn't there yet. And I think had he stayed in Boston, while he still would have hit a lot of home runs, he wouldn't have hit a total of 714 like he did in New York, because let's not forget, when Yankee Stadium was built, it was built for Babe Ruth.
True.
And the dimensions were to suit him, not to suit anything else.
But the modern-day Babe on the Red Sox is David Ortiz, and he's certainly getting his share of home runs.
Well, certainly, because he's learned to go the other way, particularly over time in Fenway Park. He can shoot to that left field wall. There's some signs that Ruth was doing that in 1919, but it wasn't dramatic enough by that point. He had only hit 10 or 11 home runs in Fenway by the time he was traded, even though he'd hit 29 for the season in 1919. In Fenway Park, he'd only hit a handful of home runs. In the Polo Grounds, however, he was already Babe Ruth.
Yeah. All right. So I've already mentioned I've got a problem with the manager, Ed Barrow.
Yeah.
I want to know, I'm for Z, why don't I get rid of Ed Barrow? He clearly did not know how to handle Babe Ruth, and the way he handled him actually affected the rest of the team.
Mm-hmm.
So why did he keep Ed Barrow?
Well, that's a good question, because there's actually some people who think that, Ed Barrow eventually became general manager of the Yankees.
Yes. And he pulls a Wade Boggs, a Jacoby Ellsbury.
Right, eventually. Exactly. And I've actually talked to people who've said to me, well, do you think Ed Barrow was already working for the Yankees and working against the Red Sox? It's interesting. There's no evidence of that. But, in baseball, you work with people you're comfortable with. Harry Frazee was comfortable with Ed Barrow. That's why he kept Ed Barrow around. And Ed Barrow was very useful to him, particularly in 1918, because he'd been in baseball a long time. And in the 1918 season, where they had to put together a roster with a lot of minor leaguers and older players, Barrow, from being around baseball so long, knew where to get those guys. So he was considered a solid baseball man, even though he hadn't managed a major league team in more than 15 years. I agree with you. I think Barrow was a mistake for the Red Sox. In fact, on the field, Harry Hooper acted as the team manager. Barrow simply made out the lineup and pushed a few buttons. But Harry Hooper came up with all the in-game strategy.
Well, then Ruth goes to the Yankees, and somehow their manager, Miller Huggins, figures out a way to get the most out of him. So his behaviors didn't change off the field. What did Miller Huggins do to get the most out of Babe Ruth?
Well, they kind of left him alone, for one thing. They stopped trying to control him. And let's not forget that in the Polo Grounds, his performance was just so extraordinary that they didn't have to do anything else. I mean, by playing every single game in the Polo Grounds, that made Ruth not a guy who was just going to hit 25 or 30 home runs. That's the guy that was going to hit 60 home runs. And that made them so much money so quickly. It was extraordinary. I mean, the Yankees went over 1 million fans that year. No team had ever done that before. In Boston at the same time, even in 1919 with Ruth, they didn't even draw half that. They couldn't get the people in the ballpark. But in New York, they turned out in droves. And in fact, they began to turn out in droves everywhere Babe Ruth played. And one of the points I make in the book is I think really with Ruth, for the first time, you had fans who were not fans of a team. They weren't Red Sox fans. They weren't Yankee fans. Every baseball fan in America was a Babe Ruth fan first.
Hey, let's get another call in. We've got Chris calling from Middlebury. Chris, thanks so much for calling. What's your question for Glenn Stout?
I found the comment interesting that Ruth would have bankrupted the Red Sox. And given that there was no free agency then, I just wonder how that would have worked. Because he couldn't have demanded a trade, could he?
He couldn't have demanded a trade, but Ruth had already shown that he was not afraid to hold out. And he'd done that several times already. If he didn't get the money that he wanted, he would make all this noise. Oh, I'm going to go into boxing, or I'm going to go into this, or I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to do all this stuff. And Frazee had a number of contract battles with him already. And, you know, Ruth, even when he went to New York, he still had his contract battles. Yes, they didn't have to pay him. But, you know, Ruth showed every sign that he would be willing to sit out if they didn't.
You even mentioned that he was going to play something called roller polo.
Yeah, roller polo at one time. And, you know, he was going to box the heavyweight championship of the world. And he actually appeared in a few movies. And he was on vaudeville. And, you know, he thought he could just make money wherever anything he did.
Well, speaking to Chris's point, though, one thing that was going on, and it was probably a Ben Johnson move, was there was kind of an unofficial salary cap.
There was an unofficial salary cap coming out of the war because teams had lost money during the war. So they basically – and the salary cap wasn't the same for everyone
right, either.
I mean, the Red Sox cap was much lower than the Yankees cap because they simply didn't have, you know, the capacity for the number of fans to support a higher payroll. So that was an issue at the same time. It was almost – the dynamics were such that Ruth was almost funneled towards New York because New York was the only place that could really pay him. New York had the ballpark where he could be Babe Ruth.
Well,
and baseball needed him to be Babe Ruth and you know, be the forefront of this new game.
Absolutely. So the Baseball Historian blog mentions you in the same breath as Roger Kahn and David Halberstam and says that you are someone who is making a serious run at the shortlist of greatest baseball authors. So what are you working on next? What's the next book for Dwayne Stout? And I don't want to get past this one.
Yeah.
It's The Selling of the Babe, but what is
– Well, the next – the book – I'm finishing up a book right now that I'm assisting someone else with, Dave Meller, who's the Red Sox groundskeeper. And I'm working on a memoir with him because David, as some people will know from an ESPN report, has suffered from PTSD for quite a long time in his life and is now getting treatment, and he wants people to know his story. So that's what I'm working on now, and then I got to come up with something else. I edit the Best American Sports Writing book every year, and I'm constantly working on one thing or another. So I've got to come up with a few more book ideas before I'm done.
All right, The Selling of the Babe, The Deal That Changed Baseball and Created a Legend, goes on sale Tuesday. You're going to be signing somewhere.
That's right. I'm going to be at the Barnes & Noble in Burlington on the 26th at 2 o'clock. So come on down. Let's talk a little baseball and sign some books. And I'm really looking forward to this because so far the reception seems great.
Glenn Stout, thanks for telling us all about this seminal moment in baseball history.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, we'll hear how technology is helping those for whom even the most basic communication has been a struggle. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Bob Kinzel. It's fair to say that technology has made communication easier for everyone. We can communicate with cell phones and on computers in ways never imagined a few decades ago. But what about those for whom even the most basic communication has been a struggle? How has technology helped them? Anthony Arguin is a little boy in Jeffersonville with complex disabilities, but a device he started using last spring is teaching his family just what Anthony is capable of. Jessica Tichton reports.
5-year-old Anthony Arguin has cerebral palsy. He also has hearing and vision impairments. His disabilities prevent him from being able to walk, feed himself, or communicate verbally. However, this doesn't mean he has nothing to say. On the contrary, when Anthony was 2 years old, his parents and older sisters realized he could understand them. Ever since, they've been trying to figure out Anthony's wants and needs through a bit of sign language and a lot of guesswork. But 6 months ago, Anthony was given a communication device, and almost right away, his inner world began to open up to them. The first things they learned about him? His mother, Tiffany Arguin, laughs as she answers this question.
He loves the Wii. Just, you know, things like that, or like specific colors. He just has such a sense of humor that he'll use with that. And like, we kind of already knew he did, but just how much more it's come out since he's been able to use this. Or just he would say something silly and we would kind of chuckle, but he thought it was hilarious. Or like, just things like that. I mean, it's been just like, you're thinking that?
They discovered that Anthony loves music and playing the piano too. Anthony's technology is called an augmentative communication device. It helps children and adults who have communication-related disabilities, or who are essentially nonverbal, to to express themselves with words. Anthony's particular device is a NovaChat 10, made by Saltillo. It's a portable speech-generating device that looks a bit like an iPad, with its 10-inch screen and colorful icons. Tiffany Arguin calls the device a talker. It generates words and phrases out loud, and Anthony can select the phrases that match his thoughts. His mom says it's made a huge difference for Anthony.
Just so excited. Like, he would throw his body around, like, when he would be frustrated, and we would know what he wanted. But for him to actually be able to go over to the talker and be like, Mom, I want a hug, and just be so excited, like, oh, she got it. Like, and just reinforcing that, too, but huge that he, you know, can communicate that this is something I need or want.
Anthony's family learned about this technology from a program called the iTeam at the University of Vermont. It's an awkward name that describes a group of specialists who provide training and technology to kids from ages 2 to 22 all over the state. These are kids who need help with both academic and basic daily life skills, many who are nonverbal, like Anthony. The iTeam works with about 150 kids in the public school system. The Arguins signed Anthony up with the iTeam when he was 2 years old.
So they brought, you know, a whole nother set of people that were able to help, especially with, first with Maureen and now Amy, that was able to help with figuring out, like, augmentative communication. And we just knew that that's how he was going to communicate, you know, once he got to a certain age, that this is where we would be heading.
Amy is Amy Starbel, a speech-language pathologist and consultant with the iTeam. She travels to remote parts of the state, meeting families who have no idea how to cope, let alone how to communicate with their children. Starbel's job is to help match technology with a child's needs. She can tell from the emotional reaction of these families when she arrives on the scene that what she also brings is hope. On a recent afternoon, Starbel visits the Arguins at home in Jeffersonville. A big group is gathered today. A speech-language pathologist from the local school, members of the iTeam, and several family members. Anthony lies on the living room rug, making grunting noises and high-pitched squeals of excitement at seeing so many people gather around him. Tiffany Arguin brings Anthony into a seated position in her lap, while Starbel works with the 5-year-old and his device. The talker has a touch screen, but Anthony struggles with motor control, so he uses a large orange button attached to the tablet. Starbel begins by reading a book.
If you have something to say, while we're reading, you go ahead.
Having a way to communicate has given Anthony a sense of control. Instead of screaming to get his mom's attention, he can use his electronic voice to tell her what he wants.
It'll have its scanning voice, but then it also has like a child's voice, so when actually you select what you wanted to say, it changes. So we'll kind of ignore, not really ignore, but ignore the adult voice that's being scanned, because it's kind of like he's thinking that. And then when he hears what he wanted to say, and he'll hit it, and it'll come in that child's voice, we're like, oh, Anthony, did you need a hug? And come like running from the other room or whatever. Just that gives, again, like more power to what this can do for him.
These devices don't come easy, though. Tiffany Arguin had to fill out what she calls a mountain of paperwork for Medicaid in order for Anthony to receive his first trial device. Now that he's been using it successfully for more than 6 months, Starbel is helping Tiffany submit even more paperwork to prove Anthony would benefit from a permanent device.
It's clear for us, but you have to, you know, you have to show that in paper explicitly. So it's taken a lot of collaboration between both teams, school and iTeam, to be able to put this together.
Starbel calls it a robust system, designed to grow with him so he won't have to change or get another one.
We wouldn't want to have to say in 5 years to shift dramatically and give him a different one. We want one that grows with him and also just has endless possibilities of how you can construct sentences by combining words and making lengthier utterances and really constructing your own thoughts.
Children like Anthony, who cannot communicate verbally, are often spoken to or talked at. They become passive observers of life, says Starbel. With this technology, she encourages teams to think about how they can help the child initiate the interaction.
I know that all kids have something to say and that it's my job to try to figure out the best way that they can do that. I can contribute that to teams and work with the school SLPs to help make sure that these kids have systems that they can use their whole lives if they need to.
When Anthony uses his device to communicate, he appears overwrought with happiness that people can understand him. The technology gives Anthony a voice, and his family can get to know the real boy living inside his disabled body. For VPR, I'm Jessica Tickton.
And that's our show for today. Coming up on Monday, experts who work on the problem of domestic violence say a new issue is emerging. A lack of affordable housing means many victims have no place to go when they try to leave an abusive relationship. Meanwhile, the connection between guns and domestic violence continues to receive scrutiny. On the next Vermont Edition, we'll look at domestic violence and the complicated issues that stem from it. Send your comments or questions to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by me, Rick Singeri, and by Sam Gale Rosen. We have production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Liam Connors directed the program, and our executive director, or producer, I should say, our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Rick Singeri. Have a great weekend.